Let's Talk Development, Season 3, Episode 3.
Hello and assalamu alaikum to everyone watching this latest episode of Let's Talk Development, which is a podcast series run jointly by CDPR and IGC. My name is Hina Sheikh and I'm the Senior Country Economist for the IGC Pakistan office, and I'll be your host for today. And today I'm joined by Dr. Nosheen Anwar, who's a prominent scholar in urban studies, city and regional planning, and the political economy of South Asia. She is a professor at IBA Karachi and the founding director of the Karachi Urban Lab, which is a research platform that examines urbanization, climate change and infrastructure governance, and also has a focus on justice and equity in rapidly growing cities like Karachi. She has a PhD from Columbia and also holds a postdoctoral position at Harvard and the Asia Research Institute, the National University of Singapore. So she brings a wealth of knowledge with her on the lived realities and politics of urban transformations in developing countries, including Pakistan, and the nexus of urban development with climate change. She also brings a strong public voice. She's been writing regularly for national and international platforms and is committed to making complex urban issues and climate issues more accessible to wider audiences. So welcome to this podcast. Today, we want to talk about climate change and how it's amplifying spatial vulnerabilities in Pakistani cities, and what we can do about it. And I think no better person to talk to about this than you. So let's start with the big picture. When we talk about spatial vulnerabilities in cities, what do we really mean? How does this play out in a place like Karachi where you live, or a place like Lahore where I live? Just want you to try to make the concept of spatial vulnerability more accessible to the general audience.
Thank you very much, Hina. First of all, very kind words, and thank you for inviting me to be a part of this conversation. So the spatial is, first of all, something that urban planners and geographers take very seriously. Aksar, many times as other social scientists and economists, the spatial aspect doesn't come into conversation quite the same way as the temporal does. Temporal is about time, when people came and how they came and how long it took them. For instance, in migration, the time factor becomes a very important one in terms of understanding people's placements and then how that impacts policy design and policy action and so forth. The spatial brings the lived reality, everyday realities of geography into consideration. And in a very, very simple sense, when we look at migration, for instance, it then becomes a matter of when people come from elsewhere, where do they come and set in? So, and the where is also in terms of specific aspects or parts of the city, specific kinds of spatial landscapes that are perhaps more vulnerable to dynamics such as infrastructure degradation, issues, complexities of land, access to water, to electricity, issues of tenure insecurity. And then also associated with that, certain kinds of environmental or ecological challenges that might exist in those specific places or locations where migrants, for instance, or even local populations might face certain kinds of inherent harms or dangers. So people living in certain kinds of spaces in Karachi or in Lahore, where they have consistent or safe access to electricity, to water, which is constant, that would be a very different lived reality to those who are living, for instance, and if I might take the example of Karachi, to say the edges of Kurangi Creek or those areas that are flood prone, where people would be more vulnerable to certain kinds of weather-related hazards and flooding hazards. And then even heat-related hazards. So the spatial aspect becomes as important as the temporal one. And this should be taken into consideration, for instance, when we design policies concerning climate crisis-related vulnerabilities for ordinary citizens.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nosheen. So I think this links very neatly with the next question that I was going to ask you, because you just mentioned that, you know, certain places are more vulnerable, or spaces where people live can be more vulnerable to climate change in cities. So they're inherently more susceptible to, you know, the impact of weather-related, events. So in that sense, just want to ask, what makes Pakistani or pockets in Pakistani cities particularly vulnerable to the effects of climate change? How much of it has to do with how well-planned or otherwise our cities are? And over time, what have you seen in urban planning?
First aspect of my answer to that question is that there is, by and large, conventional wisdom when it comes to urban planning generally says that, well, there are parts of the city that are always planned and those that are never planned. And I always say to that, everything is planned. So the planning that goes on in a DHA or a PCHS looks a certain way, and that planning that goes on in parts of a Rangi town or informal settlement looks another way, but that is also planned. But there are certain kinds of schema and certain kinds of actions and processes in place that are all about planning. But different kinds of people are doing the planning. So when DHA was being planned, you had a specific set of stakeholders involved in that planning. And then when other parts of the city are planned, for instance, those that are in low income or where you see a lot of substandard housing, there is also a certain kind of a planning criteria present, although it is not in a formal sense, in a conventional sense. So now the challenge, of course, is that in those parts of the city, if you take Karachi, for instance, or most cities across the global urban south, government intervention or municipalities' roles in the planning of those parts of the city or in the maintenance and the infrastructural upgradation and land tenure security of those parts of the cities where these sorts of dynamics are not present or are considerably weaker, then local government interventions on risk mitigation for vulnerable populations living in those areas tends to be very limited or non-existent. Now, this has a deep history. This has a kind of, it very much has a temporal aspect attached to it. If we take Pakistan's example, for instance, and its poorly planned, I would say poorly planned areas in a formal sense, since 1947 onwards, we know, for instance, that the provision of low-income housing or critical infrastructures such as shelter has not been provided. So the informal sector has kind of emerged, informal settlements have emerged, or Kachiabadis have emerged in this sense to, take up, fill that gap. And the state has kind of looked the other way. It's been a sort of a benign neglect, if one could call it that. So now it's precisely those segments of the city across many, many cities across Pakistan that require the greatest sort of upgradation in terms of providing security of tenure, providing security for the provision of water and electricity, even though water access is uneven considerably across many parts of Karachi. But it's generally those where you have substandard housing where you will also find substandard infrastructures. And cities like Karachi have grown exponentially for a wide variety of reasons. And the infrastructural upgradation priorities have not kept in sync with the city's expansion. And this is generally the case across most cities in Pakistan, generally across the global urban south, because you have waves of migration coming in for different reasons. Some is seasonal, some is long-term, some is climate change related, where people displaced from elsewhere come and settle on the city's peripheries. And these are individuals and families and communities who then go either unnoticed or are simply not counted for or simply not accounted for in the broader planning interventions that might take place in a conventional or a formal sense. So one of the biggest disjunctures or disconnects and the challenges that we face today across cities like Karachi and Lahore, especially in light of climate crises, is the infrastructure challenge, in my opinion, that simply has not kept pace with the demands of the city. And this is not only in terms of an expanding population or an expanding demographic, but it's also a question of maintenance and repair that is deeply, deeply lacking. And I know, for instance, in metropolitan Karachi, municipalities either don't have the funds or funds have not been allocated properly or they've been misspent. Budgets have come and gone. Budgets have been allocated. They have not been directed properly. There are manpower issues. There are issues of not having enough, kinds of equipment on ground for managing flood risks, for draining, roads when there is a massive flood event, for instance. And alongside that, engineering challenges, et cetera. So the infrastructural aspect, I believe, is the most critical one across the board, and especially in face of climate change.
Okay, so I think you've hit the nail on the head that I think the quality of service delivery and the infrastructure both play a very important role in enabling cities to withstand or respond to climate change impacts. And I think well-functioning municipalities or local governments can really play a big role in strengthening our service delivery in all these aspects. So for the listeners, I also now just linking this up specifically to specific kinds of vulnerabilities where you can actually see how this manifests, this lack of, focus on infrastructure. So I want to start with extreme heat, which is growing a public health crisis. We were just talking about it right now. But not everyone experiences it equally. Some are more vulnerable to it. How does urban form or housing materials or unequal access to green cover determine who suffers the most in heat waves? And, so just want to a quick response on that.
Absolutely. That's a great question, Hina. And we know, for instance, now that because of global warming, there is no part of the world that is actually cooling. It's getting hot everywhere. And certainly in cities across Pakistan, we face multiple challenges when it comes to the increasing dynamic of extreme heat. And this is not just in relation to heat waves. I always make the distinction that there are heat waves, which are one-time events. And then there's chronic heat, and which is long-lasting. And this is largely because we're seeing rising temperatures, but in the context of longer summers. And certainly at Karachi Urban Lab, we have produced some very, very good data on what, if we take Karachi as a proxy, over 60 years, what do rising temperatures look like in the local context? So that's a report that's on our website on heat governance. So very, very simply put, now I don't want to make simplistic divisions by saying that, well, informal settlements are more vulnerable and those that are not are less vulnerable. There is a question, first of all, in terms of the amount of concrete that it continues to be poured into the environment, and that the kinds of materials that have been used for a very long time now in terms vis-a-vis how our cities are built. So the way that our cities have been built across the board, they are not prepared for these extreme heat-related dangers. And if I just bring it down to a very, very simple example. So when we start looking at substandard housing, for instance, where critical infrastructure such as water and electricity and ventilation are very limited or present in terms of constrained access, then we're looking at scenarios where people are, say, if we take Karachi as a proxy, then where people are living on in teeny tiny homes, ground plus one, plus two, plus three, in perhaps highly dense environments where ventilation and cooling infrastructures are very limited. So when we have the extreme heat factor intervening, then it's not just a question of, well, it's a heat wave, so people should stay indoors. What happens under those circumstances then is that the indoors perhaps becomes even more dangerous than the outdoors. And certainly in the kind of work that my colleagues and I have done at the Karachi Urban Lab, we have found several case studies, for instance, with female domestic workers who work at home, saying that when heat waves come or when the long hot summer comes along and you have load shedding and then you have limited access to water, it's very difficult for us to work at home. And so these are peace workers, people who are linked to the broader value chain of, say, the garment manufacturing industry or working from home. And so typically women say that our productivity falls and we can't cope. And so this distinction also in terms of heat being an ever-present danger outside actually also has to be complicated because the indoors might become even hotter. So now this is a very different kind of a scenario, say, from people living in environments, and these could be middle-income environments where they have access to fairly decent cooling environments. And, just maybe having access to one air conditioner could make a difference in their lives, right? Where you cool off one room and everybody huddles together in that room and people time it. So people do have coping skills and they do have strategies that they deploy in terms of using certain kinds of technologies. But at the opposite end of the spectrum, there are many, many households across Karachi. And I just came back from Jacobabad a couple of weeks ago for the site selection for our 3 to 4 year project on extreme heat, where we're using Jacobat as a proxy because, you know, over there, ambient temperatures exceed 51 Celsius. And, you know, we were looking at middle income communities, communities living in peri-urban regions, and then communities living in informal settlements. And people's access to cooling infrastructures and their and the built environment and materials used to build their homes varies considerably across these different kinds of neighborhoods. And this is just in the city of Jacobabad. And we're looking at a city that's considerably smaller than Karachi. But again, the spatial and the temporal intervenes. And what we saw was that those who are living in informal settlements are generally always the worst off, because that's where you find the most substandard housing and where you find the most constrained access to cooling infrastructures, which includes ventilation, electricity, and water.
You mentioned the term chronic heat, right? So I just want to, for my own understanding also, how would your coping mechanism vary in terms of dealing with chronic heat versus a major sort of heat wave or just a one-off like heat wave event, extreme weather event? So just a quick response on that.
That's a really terrific question. So the evidence on ground so far suggests, for instance, that when heat waves come, so in Karachi, for instance, you have a heat wave management plan. So the Disaster Management Authority sends out typically a warning that people should stay indoors, and which is not off the mark typically, right? And those who have access to cooling infrastructures then do stay indoors. Those who don't have access to cooling and are living in substandard housing generally find it far more difficult to be able to manage the indoor-outdoor exposure element and are generally worse off. Under chronic heat circumstances then, and this is something actually that has not been investigated, and this is something that we are aiming, my colleagues and I are aiming to investigate in the context of our Jacobabad study, is that when you have that one unseen climate event, and by that I mean an event that really sort of, you know, transgresses the thresholds of what is considered, you know, normal or whatever under conventional circumstances, you might have a heat wave that is unprecedented. So this is something that, you know, you have to kind of hang out there in the field and take a look at, we know that in Jacobabad 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, it crossed 51 Celsius. And this is what people were doing. But what if that temperature just keeps on, you know, getting pushed further and further and further? So what do people do under those circumstances? So this is something that we're actually looking at. And then how does it pan out in terms of chronic heat? So one very interesting aspect of the long summers is that people may deploy seasonal migration interventions. And this is something that we have found in terms of anecdotal evidence so far in the preliminary work that we have started in Jacobabad. And this is an old story. But this is also interesting that in regions like those places that exist in that belt along Sindh, northern parts of Sindh where Jacobabad is positioned, people have been using migration as a coping mechanism for decades. So typically, even in people who are of low income stature, families will huddle together and they will collect together and they will collectively migrate for 4 or 5 months. They will go, for instance, to Quetta. And this is the story on ground in Jacobabad. So there is a whole community of bricklayers in the peri-urban region of Jacobabad. And when round about mid-May, and we just caught them in the nick of time when we were in Jacobabad a few weeks ago, they were preparing to leave, and there were, you know, dozens and dozens of families who then just collectively, you know, take their stuff and they go off to Quetta, and then they don't come back until November, because a city like Jacobabad has actually two cycles of heat. There's the dry heat that starts in March, and then there's the humid heat that starts in August. So people have been practicing seasonal migration for centuries. But the big question then is that even under chronic heat circumstances, when the ambient temperature keeps rising, to what extent do these kinds of seasonal migration interventions then make a difference in people's lives? What's actually happening in places like Quetta? What are people taking with them? You know, because it could be that even Quetta might be getting hotter, right? So these are questions that keep coming up. So these are different kinds of interventions and coping skills that people deploy. But we'll have a much better sense of this a year and a half, 2 years down the road to be able to share this with you when the time comes.
So looking forward to your research on that. There are two other vulnerabilities that I wanted to talk about. One was urban flooding and then air pollution. So just quickly on urban flooding, because I know a lot of it also has to do, again, with infrastructure. So just want to, I mean, it is a recurring crisis, especially in Karachi. Urban flooding has been, a well-known phenomena. Why are the same neighborhoods prone to the same kind of flooding year in and year out? Is there some kind of land politics or infrastructure decisions, that are not happening? Is that part of the story? Just a few words on that.
Well, I think fundamentally this is a question of drainage engineering, really. And of course, that is also very political. I mean, infrastructure is always political. Engineering is also political. So, and sure, there's land politics and there's housing politics involved. There's land politics involved. Why are people settled, for instance, on the edge of the banks of the drainage channels in Karachi, Gujranwala and these places? Why did they come and settle there? Well, they came and settled there because, you really didn't provide them access to low-income housing or shelter in any other ways. And when they came and settled on the edges of those drainage channels, the state kind of looked the other way. And then the drainage channels have not been they've not been cleaned properly. There is a huge wash challenge in cities like Karachi, municipalities, capacities to take care of these drainage channels has been undermined over the years. It's resource, it's politics, it's all of these things. I'm sure you're already familiar with that story. Arif Hasan Saab has written about this, ad nauseum along with other people. So, and typically under climate change circumstances, when we had the 2022 floods, for instance, and even earlier, 3 years earlier, when the precipitation was very intense, these drainage channels essentially overflowed. And when they overflowed, you had typically specific parts of the city that were impacted first. And especially those people living along the channels, along the embankments of these drainage channels, along these riparian zones. And typically then the politics of this is that when the government sort of wakes up to this challenge, it says that those people who are sort of living on the edges of those channels are encroachers. So the politics that falls out of that is a very violent politics often, and where people then, they get evicted, they get displaced. And what we've seen in the Karachi context, unfortunately, is that these drainage channels are not any better off, despite the engineering interventions that have unfolded over the last 3 years for disaster risk management. And there is another kind of politics behind that, too. So certain areas are at risk for these very reasons. But these are, I want to be able to say that these are straightforward solutions. They should be straightforward solutions. Local municipalities, local government has a responsibility to attend to wash-related issues. And they should be attending to these issues consistently and with the proper resource deployment, because this is, again, part of the whole infrastructure story of repair and maintenance. So you get this right. You get the infrastructure story right. And you might just be able to put in place a sensible risk mitigation agenda, both in terms of policymaking and action, that impacts people's lives in a positive way. So, these are engineering solutions, resource allocation, repair, maintenance, these kinds of things. These are the mundane aspects of the everyday maintenance of a city, but they are the most critical, the most important aspects, essentially.
Yeah, I think infrastructure is just something that it's a quick fix also, if you look at it like that. But, I'm not sure why our policymakers are not focusing on this easy solution. And now we come to the third vulnerability, air pollution, which is the Lahoris experience it quite often. But now Karachi and other cities also choke at certain times of the year. What are we missing when we talk about air pollution? Like, we treat it as a seasonal or technical issue. Is it really that? The way that you can counter pollution is also, you can counter climate change that way as well. So, I mean, they're not exactly, the root causes might be different, but they can be addressed in the same way. But I just wanted to hear from you what you have to say on this.
Yeah, pollution is now absolutely, the Lahore case, of course, is the outlier in many ways. So Karachi itself is also now suffering pollution and suffering really on a consistent basis. And people often say, well, the thing that saves us is the sea breeze, but only to a certain extent, because, the triggers for pollution, there are multiple triggers for pollution now. And pollution also increasingly dovetails with extreme heat. So when you have longer summers and rising temperatures, the pollution factor also intensifies because both mix together. And perhaps the humidity factor to some extent also. And then we have all the garbage that doesn't get picked up, that's all over the city. People burn that garbage. There is also the issue of pollution related to industrial and vehicle, outputs. So all of these things come together actually to create vulnerabilities for populations, for the elderly, for children, issues related to breathing difficulties. I'm not an expert on this, but I do know in a very anecdotal sense, medical scientists in Karachi associated with some of the big universities who've been saying that, our respiratory illnesses are on the rise in Karachi and this is related to pollution. I'm actually involved in a pollution-related project these days with a bunch of different colleagues, and we're in the midst of installing these specific kinds of pollution measuring tools. Have installed them already across the city in Pakistan, in Karachi, sorry. And on the basis of this project, some of the data that will be coming in, we'll be able to get a better sense of, what are the parts of the city that are more vulnerable to these pollution tendencies as opposed to others. And this will be looking at these pollution outcomes from a slightly longitudinal sense rather than just a short-term basis.
I think it's also, there's also behavioral science aspect to it as well. I think sharing information on air pollution and getting the right information, measuring it correctly is also important. IGC did some research on, understanding how people value information that is shared on air pollution. And they did find that citizens do value it, and citizens might respond to it in a positive way and take some preemptive measures also. But I just feel like there is a big opportunity here that the government is missing out on, which is really sharing information and just creating awareness. And, that can be like an early warning system, in place. And I think when we're talking about measuring, let's bring focus to the data gaps that we have. From your work, what are some of the glaring data gaps in how we track these urban vulnerabilities, especially in the context of climate change? For example, is there any information on informal settlements, street vendors, on gendered experiences of spaces? What kind of urban knowledge is being left out? So just, on that.
Yes, absolutely. That's a terrific question, Hina. So I think there are two things. So on the one hand, you have, again, if we take Karachi as a proxy, so you have the heat wave management plan that was put in place after the 2015 heat wave. And by and large, it's a good management plan, although I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of too much criticism, but by and large, it's a good intervention. And so when heat waves happen and then the disaster warning goes out, it does save lives to the extent that we are aware of, essentially, the extreme heat factor from indoor extreme heat exposure is something that has not been looked at, right? So we have a data gap on that, essentially. That when you look at, and this is not just in terms of substandard housing and households, this is, for instance, schools, prisons, a myriad different kinds of spaces where people are stuck indoors and heat waves come and then the chronic heat factor unfolds. And so what are children experiencing? What are school teachers experiencing? What's happening inside prisons? What's happening inside the homes and where people live in substandard housing? What kinds of challenges are they facing? So data on this is certainly lacking. And I've been on the advisory, the technical advisory group of the World Health Organization and the World Meteorological Organization, WHO, WMO, that a year and a half, 2 years ago, launched a project on the indoor risks to health from overheating. And they've now recognized that when we think about extreme heat, it's not enough to just think about the heat that is outdoors. We need to also take a really, really close look at what's happening indoors in people's lives, those who are the vulnerable populations, and especially those who simply don't have access to cooling infrastructures. So there is a huge data gap on this in Pakistan. And so we remain stuck in that sense. in terms of thinking about, you know, just heat waves and stay indoors. And well, there's this whole aspect of the indoors that has to be taken into consideration. Secondly, on the occupational health and extreme heat, you know, relationality aspect, street vendors, the importance of shade. So the Karachi Urban Lab, we've done work on this, that, you know, in cities like Karachi, shade is something that is increasingly diminishing. And that is also in large part because of the kind of construction that is going on throughout the city. And in some of the older neighborhoods and even some of the informal settlements, these are usually areas that have the least access to green spaces or to shade, shade especially. And it's not enough to have green spaces. So we know that the mayor of Karachi has been sort of, you know, giving accolades and praising the kinds of green spaces that are being built across the city. And those are actually just concrete and a bit of green grass that is planted. And so this notion of shade brings a very other important aspect into conversation, and that is design. How do we design shade whilst we are losing it? So so this is, you know, so where can, you know, construction workers, you know, find shade in those moments of crises when it's a super hot day? But we also know that for street vendors, et cetera, they have risk mitigation strategies. So for instance, they know it's getting hotter and hotter, so they won't work. They won't expose themselves to hot environment on certain days of the week. But they also say simultaneously that it affects their earnings. And it does affect their productivity and their earnings. So this is something we need to take a closer look at. You know, gig economy workers, you know, delivery workers, riding on motorcycles, delivering food in under extreme heat conditions, wearing a helmet, you know, and feeling hot, and security guards who you know, languish outside in the heat, policemen who languish outside in the heat on very, very hot days. And all of this, it's not just about heat exposure. It's also about the kind of health issues that those raises, because heat is a stealth killer. It's a stealth killer. You know, flooding usually gives us a very visceral impact. Things break down, you know, floods happen, trees fall apart, homes fall apart. But heat is a very stealth-like killer. So there are health risks associated for a vast array of, you know, vulnerable populations, both indoors and outdoors.
So I think, you know, you mentioned a very important point, that it matters whose voice or experiences are included and how we are designing or making these, for example, plans or, you know, resilient plans or trying to address risks or disasters. Which brings me to equitable urban climate policy making. What would that look like in a city like Karachi, you know, or Lahore or Quetta, like places, centers that are most at risk? What would that include?
So, by default, I would say that an equitable and, more to the point, a just climate action policy that is led by municipalities in conversation with different kinds of stakeholders and multiple stakeholders would position, first of all, gender as a key aspect of everything. So I've been noting, for instance, in the climate action plan for Karachi that has been put out there, gender is more of a footnote than something that should be positioned at the forefront of every conversation in relation to risk mitigation and resilience of communities. And I say this not just in terms of, well, we should be focusing on women. I mean gender in every sense of the word. You know, that we bring a host of different gendered bodies into conversation with what a grounded climate action policy looks like, because the gender component has a very, very close tie with the vulnerability dimension. Both are interrelated, and you cannot look at one without looking at the other. And I feel that this is where our conversations and our policy plans are lagging the most. So when the gender aspect comes in, it comes in very much at the end, and it comes in as a kind of a footnote on a separate section, when in fact it should be something that should be rolled into every dimension of a climate action policy, from the upgradation of homes to the provision of water to the provision of electricity to the design of ventilation systems to the provisioning and inputting and bringing together of certain kinds of materials, and generally the full thrust of urban planning in cities across Pakistan. So for me, really, that is where climate justice and equitable urban planning really lies. And this has been the challenge for us. You know, it's not just something that should be pro poor, but it's something that should position gender at the heart of every action and every policy debate.
We're almost coming to the end, but I just also wanted to ask that often there's always a risk that even when you are making some well-meaning climate policies, they will exclude certain people. So even if we are, this could be an issue of design, or it could be an issue of not having enough data that we already spoke about, we may actually end up pushing people out. So, you know, when you talk about green gentrification or evictions or beautification drives, so how can we design policies that don't repeat this cycle of exclusion that we've been seeing for so many years now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those three points, Hina, that you pointed out, spot on, right? So we already know what they are, right? But the question then is, to what extent to sort of the policymakers and the bureaucrats sitting at the helm of national, provincial and local government in Pakistan, to what extent are they aware of these kinds? Everyone wants beautification. And I know at the, you know, in the one day conference that was held at IBA, which you had very kindly invited me to, there were certain senior bureaucrats who were sitting there talking about parks. And I was trying to make the point that it's not beautification conversations are not enough. That was exactly the example. And he was saying, you know, well, we're building parks here, we're building parks there. And I said, you know, no, there is this notion of syndemic risks, right? What are syndemic risks? Syndemic risks are precisely how, you know, certain populations in certain clusters are particularly vulnerable to certain kinds of diseases, and that these diseases are in turn driven by environmental and structural dynamics. So we need to turn our attention to the complexity of these problems and not focus on how green a park looks or how pretty it looks. So I think that this is where certainly the kind of initiative that your colleagues and you took at IBA is a very important one. And actually where these conversations can be really made bare bones, and doesn't matter how, hence they get also, and incendiary they might get. But I think that this is where it all begins, with these kinds of conversations that have to be iterative and have to be frequent.
Yes, I think there are many organizations that are doing a lot of work, a lot of think tanks, and I think they can come together to really sort of articulate a position on this and, have these kinds of exchanges. Coming to the end of the podcast, I just wanted to, if you have any parting thought, big idea, or just something that you want to leave our listeners with on about cities and its nexus with climate change or climate justice in Pakistan, what would it be?
So I would like to end on a hopeful note. And I hate the word hope. And I just came out of a meeting in Brussels where colleagues spent a great deal of time sort of opening up the black box of hope, and we decided it's a terrible word. But I would say that on a positive note, if I take the city that I have worked on the most in Pakistan, the city is Karachi, there are some absolutely incredible things happening on ground. There is the Pakistan Mohali Tahafuz movement, and there are many, many other interventions taking place in terms of awareness raising, in terms of youth becoming involved in a plethora of different kinds of interventions. It would be wonderful to see that momentum maintained in conjunction with greater partnerships with municipal institutions. And that's, I think, where the connectivity lies, to make cities resilient and to make communities resilient. The word resilience has been bandied about a lot, but I think that one way to think about resilience is that, how do we make these partnerships happen? How do we build that momentum and take it forward and keep it up? Because I think that that's where the energy lies, and that's where the goodness and all the positivity lies for making cities like Karachi and others resilient for better futures for everyone.
Well, on that positive and hopeful note, we can now end this discussion. But thank you so much, Dr. Nausheen, and to everyone who's going to be listening and or watching this podcast, for this amazing exchange. I definitely learned a lot, and I'm sure whoever is going to be listening in will get great insights. So thank you once again for your time.